From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made 2 weeks ago with the release of a report by the RAISE Commission, the Commission on Racial and Structural Equity. The commission was launched last year with support from both Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren and Monroe County Executive Adam Bellow. The final report runs more than 200 pages and is titled No Time for Excuses, It's Time for Action. Right from the start, the final report notes that people of color tend to be left out of the halls of power and policymaking. The report says, quote, people of color are denied the opportunity to participate in the rulemaking and decision-making that shapes our lives from birth to death, end quote. The report declares, quote, the entire county of Monroe has a racial problem, one that is not contained within its largest municipality, Rochester, and it is a problem that must be fixed, end quote. But how? The commission offered a damning view of local government's lack of transparency, denying information to the public, to journalists, to the commission itself at times. If local government won't be transparent, how can we expect local government to work with openness and urgency to fix these problems? Our guests this hour are two of the co-chairs of the RAISE Commission. Soon, we'll be joined by Dr. Mohammed Shafiq. And now let me welcome the former mayor of Rochester and co-chair of the RAISE Commission, Bill Johnson, back to the program. Bill, welcome. Thanks for making the time.
Thank you, Evan, for the opportunity.
Now, there was an open question on the week of September 2nd about whether the RAISE Commission could even do the work it was charged with doing. This report, Bill, you know, reading this report, it is filled with condemnations about the lack of transparency in local government at pretty much all levels. And when news broke on September 2nd about the death of Daniel Prude, it became clear that Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren had kept that information from you and the commission, from the commissioners. Let me read from the RAISE report about that now. Quote, members of the RAISE Commission were equally outraged upon learning that the mayor had not informed them of Daniel Prude's death at the time of their appointment to the commission. The mayor asserts that she first learned of the mishandling of the Prude case on August 4th, and she swore in the members of the commission on August 10th. She, County Executive Bellow, and Chief Singletary, who did not attend, were invited to meet virtually with the full commission on Labor Day morning. Many of the newly sworn commissioners, some of whom had been at the rallies, expressed outrage at the actions of the police. They were equally perturbed that the mayor had not disclosed this matter at the time of the swearing-in, and there was a lengthy discussion of whether the commission could do its work under circumstances where trust was so low. After nearly 2 hours of intense discussion, there was agreement to continue, end quote. Bill, why did you decide you could go on with this work, knowing that city leadership had not been forthright with you about a case of such significance?
I think that the commissioners collectively understood the importance of this work, understood the importance of the moment, and that we would likely not get another opportunity. And also, we understood, and it took maybe a bit of a while for us to come to this realization, that even though this action on the part of the mayor had been very damning, that it almost liberated us to do our work in a kind of independent fashion. Because we said at the time, when we, whatever findings we develop and produce, we're not just going to turn them over to the mayor and the county executive. We're going to simultaneously release them to the public. So there'd be no way possible that there could be any cover-up or any failure to pursue. The community would know exactly what we have recommended, and we also put in it a very stringent implementation process that says we're just not going to let this die. There have to be steps. The mayor and the county executive have to consciously develop follow-up steps in a very short term. And they have to go through very specific processes of finding out what is it that can be done almost immediately, what has to take a longer term to complete, what needs resources, where do those resources come from. But you just can't say we're not going to do anything about it. We're not going to let this happen. So I've been in contact with the mayor and the county executive. I am convinced they understand the urgency of this. I think, without trying to demean them in any fashion, I think they understand they don't have any choice but to respond in an affirmative and an aggressive way to these recommendations. So once we realized, and the mayor was very humble by this. I mean, she wasn't in the room. She didn't deny, you know, that we had a basis for being upset. She couldn't explain why these actions had occurred the way they did. But I think at a point she says, I need this work. It needs to be done. And we decided among ourselves to let us continue. And not one single commissioner walked away from that process. And there were some, Evan, who had actually been on the receiving end of the police aggression, being hit in the face with pepper balls, mm-hmm. breathing in, all of that spray. Even those people said there's work that needs to be done, and this is the right time to get it done.
Now, this report attempts to do, I mean, I kind of think of it as two important things, Bill. First, diagnose the problems specifically, then offer the solutions specifically. And we can't get into all 200-plus pages this hour. We're probably going to have multiple conversations with the commissioners as we go forward on this. But I want to ask you just to start by telling us, what are some of the most important problems that the commission diagnosed?
Well, obviously, the initial focus was policing and mental health, given the elements of the Daniel Prude case. The mental health took on a greater importance once we understood the things that could have been done for Mr. Prude that weren't done. And also, let me speak from my point, from a historical perspective, things that the Rochester Police Department had invested resources in. I mean, we had an emotionally disturbed persons response team that was started back in 2004. We spent a lot of money training police officers to do that work. There were protocols set up to ensure that any time one of these situations broke out, officers would be dispatched to the scene. And that didn't happen. When I watched that video, I looked at it with that knowledge. I said, where are those people? Where are those officers that were specifically trained, you know, to come in and defuse this kind of situation, to respond to it in a more professional and humane way? And to this day, I haven't gotten any satisfactory response as to why did those resources go away. So that became a part of it. But, you know, those other seven areas are equally important. And one of the things that we found, and when you read this report, and I want to suggest today to people, as we have our conversation, how this 282-page report can be more easily read and digested, okay? When you read the report, you see these interconnective issues. You know, things that happen in the area of education, that happen in the areas of housing, that happen in the areas of job creation. And rather than trying to attack them separately, when you understand the interconnectivity of them, the systemic issues that are involved, when you can unravel the systemic causes of these issues, you solve the problem in more than one area. So this is the kind of approach that's taken. Let me tell you what are the critical elements of this report. We had 9 working groups. Each of those groups were facilitated by one of the 21 commissioners who were officially appointed. And then the opportunity was opened up to other people in the community to volunteer. You choose a group you want to work on, and there's no qualifications, just your interests, all right? So we had groups that ranged between 15 and 30, and sometimes even larger number of people. Some people came in and left the process. But we had pretty much about 150 people spread across these 9 areas who consistently stayed with the process. They came up with their findings. And in some areas, Evan, there were a huge number of findings, Now, we said then we can't present all of this to the community at once. So they went through a very strategic process of prioritizing. And they came up with their top priorities, which rose to this level of reporting. And then they identified those which remained. Some of them would take a longer amount of time. And they created this term called parking lot. So when you go in to look at all 9 working group reports, even though they're not consistent in format. They pretty much are consistent in outcome and focus. You will see the major issues that are prioritized. You will see those that are left to be addressed at a later time. Then you go forward to the report. So you actually would start reading this report backwards, because those working group reports take up well over 150 pages. So we didn't want to put that up front, because nobody's going to read 150 pages. Very few people are going to read 150 pages, all right? So now we summarize it, and you find that there is a discussion over around starting on about page 31, where the priorities of each of the 9 working groups are stated. And they're stated there very clearly. Then you come to this question of cross-cutting themes. Where do we find some of these issues being repeated across working groups? Let's pull that together into a format so people could understand it. And it's after that that you get to the specific recommendations, all right? And those recommendations number about 50, and they are grouped under about 5 different categories for consistency. And they're in, starting on a page about 57, there are about eight pages of that. And following that is the implementation strategy. Now, I think when I tell people, if you read the first 69 pages of the report, you really understand the all of the elements that are found. If you want more of the details, if you want to understand, well, how did they arrive at this, then you go back and you look at the specific working group reports. So I think this is easily understood. Now, here is the concept, and I know when Dr. Shafiq, he's finishing class, but when he joins us, he can really speak to this point more eloquently than me. We say there are really 4 types of racism that exist among human beings, that which each of us have in ourselves. We have prejudices. We dislike certain groups or certain individuals. And then there's the interpersonal racism, when two people react to each other, and one in a position of power, one in a position of powerlessness, and you create this kind of individual racism. Institutional racism means that individual institutions have specific policies, blah, 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 and we discussed that. All of this is found on page 24. But where we are focused is on structural racism. And this is something that I believe people have to really begin to understand. And this is why we want to have as many community dialogues as possible to get people to understand it. That's when the cumulative effect of all of these actions are now, I use the term, baked into standard rules and procedures, okay? And you may take it for granted. You say, well, there's no blatant racism here. There's no ugliness. I haven't seen any kind of negative kind of encounter. What you are looking at is the cumulative impact. If you say that the way the system is applied, it tends to leave out a whole race of people. It tends to disadvantage a whole race of people. Then you got a problem that now has to be unraveled. And I think that this is what this report is talking about. So we talk about poverty. We talk about poor education, okay? And why is it that all of the bad education, all of the dysfunctional education, all of the low-performing education is found in communities where people who are also disadvantaged by low income status, by poor health care services, by the inability to participate in the full stream of activities? Why are all of the good outcomes found in communities with high income status, with unimpeded access to services? So then you have to say, it's not an accident. because you see it, not just in Rochester or Albany or Buffalo or Syracuse. You see this same result happening all across the country. And this is where we have to get people's minds and hearts to understand that while they may not have individually ever committed an act of racism, they are just good-hearted people. They still are in a system which every day perpetuates it. And you know, Evan, there are other reports. The state of Virginia had a study. The governor of Virginia commissioned his own structural racism commission. The state of North Carolina, the governor down there. And we're talking about southern states which have had a history of racial oppression and discrimination, where they are saying, we now need to go back and look at what has resulted. There hasn't been legalized school segregation in Virginia since 1958. I was still in high school. And the so-called massive resistance to integration laws were on the books, put on the books by the politicians when they began to go in and say, this is not enforceable. We're going to stop doing this. Well, 62 years later, the schools in Virginia are more racially segregated than they were back in 1958. Why? So those are the kinds of inquiries that we're saying that people have to begin to engage in and to say, if you say you're not racist, but if you want to continue to benefit from a system which structurally maintains racism, and you're not willing to do anything about it, I can't even look into your heart and say what you are, but I do know you are ignoring. Mm. You're ignoring very, very compelling evidence to the contrary. So that's, in a kind of a summary, what the work that we are doing and other communities are doing around structural racism is all about.
And I want to encourage our listeners to read the report. We'll post links to it. This is a document that the leaders in our community in government at various levels are going to be engaging with and looking to for support and solutions. I want to bring in Dr. Muhammad Shafiq, who was one of the co-chairs of the RAISE Commission, who's with us now. Dr. Shafiq, thanks for taking the time to join us.
Oh, most welcome. Thanks a lot for inviting me.
And what I want to focus on for the remainder of the hour is a question of generally and then specifically on solutions here. Dr. Shafiq, you're someone who has you know, you've been involved in a number of working groups, of commissions, of interfaith groups. There are many different people who have proposed solutions over the years to various problems that probably show up right here on these 282 pages. Do you see solutions within reach, Dr. Shafiq?
You know, this is a very good question. I think the way we have designed it, there are ways that which is in the means of the county and the city, which they can easily implement. And I want to go on a few of them. And there are other areas that we have to reach out to the state, and maybe in some areas we have to reach out to the federal government. But what we can do here in the city and the Monroe County? So the first thing which all nine groups agree, first of all, even what Mayor Bill Johnson said, this report is a comprehensive report. I don't see such reports. It actually diagnoses the whole issue together. It's not policing alone. It's not criminal justice or mental health. It diagnoses the whole issue. So anyway, coming back to your question, the first thing is cultural competency, which is all nine groups agree on that. All nine groups have put different ways how cultural competency can happen and why that is essential. I want to lay out two areas there which are easily we can implement. One is racial, religious, and cultural competency for all Monroe County and Rochester city employees. You know, that's easy to do that. We do that for the teachers. I conduct some of those programs also of cultural competency. So that is annual training which should happen for all. If you look into the curricula, most of these people graduated, those who are working from educational institution where there was no cultural competency. Even in high school, you can see very little start. There is no diversity and inclusion which is taught. Similarly, in colleges, now I see even Nazareth College and some other colleges are changing curricula to include diversity and inclusion in the curricula. But this time, this is very essential to continue. This is sort of continuing education process which should happen. It doesn't cost money. It's easy to do it. And, and the city and county can arrange it easily. Second thing is, which is a bit of the issue, is policing. The policing issue has three components there. One is the recruitment process. The other is the curricula, which is there for training process, for training of the policing. And then the selection is also very important. How you select after they pass the civil service exam, how the selection process happens. So the curricula needs to be changed. Also, one thing, even which I have noticed in my experience, the policing and law enforcement agencies are trained to show strength. They have little, which I see in their training, have no humane tendencies there. In other words, the spirituality side is lacking there. I have done this for the correctional facilities, and I saw that how in correctional facilities, the religious leaders which work there, how they feel there. There is a gap between the law enforcement and the religious leaders there. So that's one area I think we need to, the policing area needs really two types of training. And one is in the same way, racial, religious, and cultural competency. Second is mental health and addiction services, how to handle that. We used to have it in Rochester before, but that is no more happening. I think this is some area which we can do it. And some of the changes which needs in the recruiting and the civil service, certainly we need to reach out to the state of New York how to bring those changes. Second thing is there is a there is no interconnectedness among the different services which are there in Monroe County and Rochester area. That is important. How interconnectedness can happen? I think the Monroe County executive and also the city mayor need to sit together and work out that interconnectedness in services. That's very important, that how the services can be delivered. I want to give you some example, mm-hmm. which I think it can happen. So community health centers could be created. And my other idea is to create community health services, we need to meet with strong hospital and RGH and others, medical facilities. You know, they have created urgent care, sort of it. Now, how we can create out of urgent care community health centers where there could be local skilled mentors also, to identify distressed persons before. In other words, we can have additional mentors available there, especially for mental health and addiction services, and how those people could be helped in early stage of their life. Another suggestion which has been given, even in the primary education, to have someone, a mentor there. We have the counselor there, but to have a mentor, we have nurses also, but to be trained nurses and mental health also, so that to identify those kids which has problem in the beginning. And that will be very good to take care of them so they can grow as really civil citizen of our country. So how to help them in the beginning. There are quite a few other things which others have said, our group has suggested different groups. One is community accountability. That accountability is sort of not ombudsman, but accountability from the community. In other words, to have that community members, part of the county and the city, to be looking after different services which are delivered. I think that's a very good idea. Again, it is not costing much what you can see. certainly, there is discriminatory practices in different areas, in social health services and other areas, that you can see those discriminatory, and especially discriminatory practices in the criminal justice, which has been pointed out very clearly how we can do and how the county can help in those areas. And some of the areas certainly would need to, meaning there has to be something to reach out to the state to bring some changes. So these are quite a bit, a few things which I mentioned that most of this could be done without much of expenses from the city and county. And most of these could be, I think, within the means and within the authority of the county and city. If you look to the 9 reports, they go in detail. A lot of areas are there which can be certainly improved if these reports could be looked into it.
Well, and I'm glad Dr. Shafiq brought up cultural competency and the subject of police training. After this, our only break of the hour, we're going to talk about what the commission, the Reyes Commission, found when it comes to police training. And this will be a subject that I think listeners will really want to hear more about, because that's one of the most common questions we're getting right now. Can you do a show, people will ask, on police training? What are they actually trained on? What's in the training? What's not in the training? We'll tell you what the Reyes Commission said about that, and we'll get specific with them about how to deal with cultural competency and a lot more with officers on the other side of this break on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, there are more than a dozen candidates for Rochester City Council, numerous open seats, and the election is in June, less than 3 months away. Our intention is to bring all of the candidates to you at length before the election. City Council will have a big say in policing, economic development, and other reforms. Next hour, you will meet 3 of the candidates on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. The Reyes Commission's final report is now out. It's the Commission on Racial and Structural Equity that was charged last year with diagnosing problems with racial inequality in our community and then proposing solutions and a path forward. And that report is one that we will post on our various platforms so you can see it and engage with it yourself. 2 of the co-chairs of the commission, Bill Johnson and Mohammed Shafiq, are with us this hour. And on the subject of police training, I want to read from what the report says about that. Quote, "Regrettably, we were not able to acquire the specific curriculum due to the New York State Division of Criminal Justice Services requiring a Freedom of Information Law request before releasing it. The police working group strongly recommends the basic police officer course curriculum be designated as public information. For that which we have been able to access, the following recommendations have been developed. Our working group recommends significantly increasing this requirement to include cultural competency training, implicit and explicit bias training, procedural justice training, and historical aspects of police training. Although we were informed that de-escalation training is provided in numerous aspects of police recruit training, we were not able to examine what that entailed. As such, we are recommending that de-escalation training be outlined and expanded for all uniformed police in this region with a focus on humanity and sanctity of life consideration," end quote. Bill Johnson, I want to turn back to you for some thoughts here. First of all, I want to strongly endorse the idea that more transparency is needed at all levels of government. And when it comes to police training, I think the public ought to know how the officers that serve them are trained. So I agree with that, the Reyes Commission on that, and I hope that will change. Now, on the subject of how police are trained, I suspect, Bill, that police chiefs would say, well, we already do that. We do racial bias training now. We do cultural competency training. I mean, I don't know, but I do suspect that's what we would hear. They might say, well, we're doing more de-escalation. So are you confident that this is a specific set of proposals that would change how police are being trained?
Oh, yes. And I think it's simply amazing that this is a public function. The training of police officers at our Regional Criminal Justice Training Center is all supported by public dollars, okay? And we have a number of police agencies that participate in that. So we developed out on Scottsdale Road a very, very effective, at least when I was in office, and I'm sure that it is maintained, its sharpness, a very effective training mechanism, all right? But you hear people say, in response to Daniel Prude, the officers responded according to that training. They acted based on how they were trained. And then when you have a public body that asks to see the training curriculum, we're told we can't see it. You gotta foil it, you know, and we know what the foil is. That's not a way to facilitate the release of information. That's a way to frustrate the release of information. And they will, and as pointed out in the Prude case, the city of Rochester did everything in its power to prevent the release of those webcam videos. So we have to really begin to address that system. How, it is public. The public needs to know. Now, I want your listeners, and I think Dr. Shafiq, in a short amount of time, really touched on a lot of content. But people could get overwhelmed when he and I are talking about all this content. I want them to ask themselves questions why these disparities exist. For example, he pointed out that the major health systems have created this thing called urgent care centers. And the predominant word in that is urgent. Well, it's only urgent for a certain part of the day, okay? They are. I don't know of one of them that's open 24 hours. I don't know one of them that's open late in the evening or in the early morning hours, when a lot of this kind, the need would be greatest for that intervention. So what you end up doing is transporting those people to emergency rooms. And we already know that those are services that are overwhelmed. So one thing, let's reexamine this whole system of urgent care, how it's delivered, and to specialize it. So that's one thing. The second thing in the criminal justice system, it was pointed out to me, and let me just identify, because I heard a very strong lecture he gave the other day. John Klopas, my friend and my former colleague at RIT, outstanding criminologist, he said to me early on, one thing the Race Commission ought to do is look at the way justice is dispensed in town courts versus city court. If you are a resident of Brighton, Penfield, Parenton, and you get pulled over for DWI at 11 o'clock at night, they don't take you to the Monroe County Jail. They find a town justice. And there have been examples where the justice has gotten out of bed, stood on his front porch, and said, okay, I'm going to release you on your own recognizance. Oh, you have to post a $100 cash bond, and you go on home, and you can get up and go to work tomorrow morning. If you get stopped in the city of Rochester, you get transported to the Monroe County Jail, and you have to sit until your case gets called. Don't make the mistake of getting stopped on Friday night, because your whole weekend is shot. There is no city court.
So what should change?
Other than Sunday.
What should change?
So why do we have these two systems? You can't give me any reason to justify, except here's the end result. Very few, if any, suburban residents are inconvenienced, prevented from going to work the next day because they had too much to drink the night before, or if they got into an altercation with their spouse. There is a system which says, we're going to hold you accountable. Here you are. You appeared before the judge, the justice. There is a disposition. You're going to come back, go on home, sleep it off, and get up and go to work tomorrow morning. But if you're a city resident, may as well say goodbye to your liberty for a short amount of time. We can't justify those disparities. That's what we're talking about, and that's what I want your listeners to sink their teeth into. We have pointed out too many instances of disparities that cannot be reconciled or justified, and which, as Dr. Shafiq has said most eloquently, can be eliminated without spending a lot of money.
Well, what is the mechanism for changing that court system that you just described that is different in the suburbs than it is in the city?
Well, all of those courts come under the come under a, what do you call it, a central command. There's a chief administrative judge. He's in charge of town justices like he is city court judges. That is a system. They need to convene themselves, and they need to figure out, how do we deal with this? Somebody has pointed out to us a problem. We wanted to know, do they keep records by race? We were told by the administrative judge, we don't maintain those kind of records. Guess what? The Center for Governmental Research, our consultant, went online and found them somewhere else. Somebody is maintaining records by race. They could tell us the gender, the race, the age, and the disposition of every criminal case. And yet, within the formalized system, you know, the chief administrative judge said, we don't keep those records by race. He needs to convene a meeting, and he says, this is important records. We all going to keep them, and we all going to report them to some central source. Oh, Evan, it ain't that hard. It is really not that hard. You got to first acknowledge that the disparity exists. You have to second acknowledge there is no basis for the disparity. And third, you have to command that the disparity ends. That's all it takes.
All right. I'm going to then follow up and say to the chief administrative judges, come on, Connections. Let's respond to what the Race Commission is saying, and let's see if the people who are in charge of the system are open to acknowledging what the Race Commission and the commissioners are saying here in this report and on this program. And we'll change it. So we're going to follow up and we will invite them, because that conversation needs to happen. And it needs to happen publicly. It needs to happen transparently. Dr. Shafiq, on the subject of police training, you raised the subject of cultural competency. Are you confident that police departments, and it's not just the city of Rochester, I mean, it really, the sheriff's department and the sheriff himself was a commissioner on the Race Commission, local chiefs, et cetera. Is that kind of training happening right now to your satisfaction? And if not, are you comfortable that the Race Commission knows how to make sure it can happen?
I think we do know how cultural competency can happen, really. Which is, actually, I'm talking to some police officers how to do this training together. But, you know, if you look into this is an issue coming from, I mean, before Reagan administration, but how Reagan administration reinforced and gave wholesale authority to the police, even, you know, going to the buses, checking here and there, you know, anything they can see, they have the authority to go in and open their, you know, bag or whatever. You know all of these things. And how the, not only the SWAT team, but how this whole thing was given to police, the authority, the way they can use it. So what happened through this, that's from Reagan time onward, I mean, till today, no change has happened into this. So there is a need for injecting spirituality and humane way into the police understanding of their authority. I think there is a gap between the two, that how to understand really how to deal with the human being. And that is actually, I have seen and I have done a lot of such programs for people, not only teachers, but others. And I have seen human being is a human being. Once human being receive proper training, and you know, this is a combination of cultural, religious, which is spiritual, religious, and social. So that's actually diversity and inclusion as a whole. If that training is a week-long training, should be prescribed. And I can arrange for a week-long training, at least for 15 officers, and then you can see their thinking and their behavior eventually, bringing some key people from the community, experts on that. And then another training is very important that should continue, which you were used there before, police getting a certificate in mental health and addiction services. Mm. Because we are talking about fit services, you know, but also the police has to be trained. In other words, 24-hour switch service, but the police has to be trained in a way. If expert from the mental health is an addiction service is not there, how they can handle the situation. I think that is lacking also. So I think this two-type training program for policing is very important. The training manual, the selection, In other words, the whole document, whole thing of border service, civil service, that can be done by reaching to the state how really some changes can happen.
But and Dr. Shafiq, let me just ask you just briefly on this. You talk about training. You talk about week-long trainings. You talk about changing someone's mindset. We also had a conversation with Police Chief Jim Van Brederode from the Gates Police Department recently, who told us that his most important decisions on an annual basis is who he hires, and he has to get it right because you can train people, but you have to also hire the right people. Is it a matter, Dr. Shafiq, is it a matter of finding the right people from the get-go, or can you train people who have what in your mind might be a harmful mindset? Can you make them change?
Yeah. Well, a human being is not a static being. Human being is always through the process of change. I think I have been through a lot of change in my life, and you may guess about yourself. Every human being, every second minute of his or her life, or whosoever that person would be, change. You may not notice it at that time, but the behavioral changes happen of what you see through the environmental way that how you look and what you see around and how you appreciate and de-appreciate things. So this is a human being. So we need to give the police department an environment where they can see real spirituality in every human being, real humanness in every human being, and they can see it in themselves also. Not to be thinking just to be enforcing the law, but how that can happen. And the training which should happen should come from, say, if we are, in other words, from the people who are really trained into that, spiritually trained, diversity trained people, culturally trained people. That is one thing that should happen. But the other thing is about mental health and addiction services. That's really professional. So I think, you know, before, if you look into that, now the colleges are introducing courses. I'm teaching course also on diversity and inclusion beginning from the civil rights movement. But now they are including those courses. So you can see in our college curriculum, we are including a lot of diversity courses in different areas, which are required from the students how to take certain courses of that. Before, such requirement was not there.
So,
and therefore, students who graduated did not have any understanding of, you know, you have been to the Global Citizenship Conference.
Mm-hmm.
I have letters with me. Students who are coming from the rural areas, they say, we have never seen a colored person before. We have never seen a Jewish, Muslim, or other before. Today, we had the opportunity to sit with colored people, as well as with the faith of different person of different faith. Thank you for organizing that. That changed, and we have seen now from the rural area, certain students have become leaders in the interfaith area and diversity areas. So that is a change you bring, even from one-day training, where they get that in the environment and how that can happen in their life, in their future life, in their professional life. So all this depends. And that's what I'm suggesting, continuing education.
Sure.
And continuing education doesn't need requirement of changing the civil service law.
Yeah, let me say very quickly.
Yeah, go ahead, Bill.
I don't want to put, Dr. Speaks made an excellent point, but I don't want to put everything in the training basket, all right? In particular, in policing, it is a multifaceted process to become a police officer. You have to pass a written exam. You have to pass an agility exam. You have to pass a background check. You have to pass a psychological exam. And then your name is brought before the Civil Service Commission. I was a Civil Service Commissioner for the City of Rochester for 10 years before I became mayor, okay? I know that process inside and out. And I've seen every trick that the police department used to try to limit the number of minority candidates who got to that final stage. They passed everything, and then they came in and tried to disqualify them. So we have to literally go in and challenge them. But let me say, one of the recommendations we make in this report is, in talking about civil service reform, we add another element at the end, that the final selection body for police officers should include community residents, people from the communities that are going to be policed. They should have a voice in looking at who are these new police officers, all right? And so I think that there are just all of these different aspects of the system that have to be changed, okay? And so the training is absolutely important. And I will go back and say again, it can't be viewed as a private enterprise. It's all paid for with public taxpayer dollars, and the public has a right to know what is involved in the training. The public has a right to suggest what needs to be included in the training, and the public has a right to know how well did these people assimilate that training. You know what I'm saying? So we talk about constant recertification, reevaluation of police officers. There's just a lot of different things that are brought into this system to make it a different, more responsive, and more accountable system.
And I have to ask you about another specific proposal. And as time starts to run short, let me just stress to the audience, the Raise Commission focused on a wide range of solutions in the community. Establishment of a $15 an hour minimum wage for city and county employees. Creation of locally developed processes, certifying minority and women-owned businesses, connecting them to lenders. I mean, I could go down the list, and we will come back and talk about some of the other prongs because we can't get through all of this. But I want to offer one more point here to make sure listeners know there are specific proposals, and I want to ask, Bill, you were the mayor of Rochester. Can you do, let me go ahead and read, it's right here under police hiring. As it relates to hiring in the Rochester Police Department, the Raise Commission recommends the City of Rochester's Law Department petition Judge Geraci's court to alter the federal consent decree that the city's been under since 1975. The purpose of the decree, as written, is to increase the minority representation within the Rochester Police Department to 25%. This was reflective of the population of Rochester when it was written. However, the minority population of Rochester now stands at approximately 56%. Currently, the current language of the decree will not result in a demographically reflective police department, and we recommend changing the language in the order so that it requires the police department to accurately reflect the various racial demographic populations of Rochester and to maintain the status through aggressive hiring of minorities. Bill, can you get Rochester from 25% black and minority to 56%? Can that happen?
Well, here's the problem, and I had strenuous discussion. Wayne Harris, who was a co-facilitator and a retired deputy chief of the Rochester Police Department, he was strenuously pushing for that, and I wanted to make this point. I was mayor for 12 years. I wanted nothing worse than to see a greater representation of minority people on the police department. We never got there. That is not a ceiling. That 25% is not a ceiling. It's a floor. We haven't gotten to it. We got like 24.8%. And there are a lot of reasons why we didn't get there. It wasn't because of a lack of effort and desire. There are a lot of people in the communities of color, young people, who don't want to be police officers. You can bribe them. You can put a gun to their head and tell them they've got to be police officers. They said absolutely not. They have no respect for policing. So we have to figure out a way to overcome the antipathy, the very strong antipathy that too many people of color have about police work. And when that happens, that number is going to rise like a float. It's going to rise. There is no pressure being placed anywhere in the system to just keep it to 25%, okay? But I don't have a problem, and I said to Wayne, look, put it in there, and you'll go and find at the end a statement that I added. I said, here's the compromise. Put that number in there. It should be representative of the population. But also say the police department is going to have to work hard to overcome the resistance and the reluctance of young people of color to police work. And there's ways to do that. Okay. So if you do both of them simultaneously, we should get better results.
All right. Let me ask Dr. Shafiq about a minute left. Go ahead, Dr. Shafiq.
Yeah. I have a little bit announcement. On the 7th at noon, 12 to 1:30, a lot of people have registered. And the co-chairs, as well as policing group commissioner and the mental health and the social services commissioners will be also participating in that meeting. That will be online on April 7th from 12 to 1:30 p.m. Quite a bit of people have registered. So we want to educate people on the race commission report, how things could happen. One other point I want to bring you, Bill Johnson was a mayor and Robert Duffy was the police chief. So there was a murder in the city in one of the stores. After that, we thought about the problem. Robert Duffy and I met together, and then we did a series of programs for the police department and the local stores, which are the corner stores, which are there. Changing the mentality of the corner stores and the police department, how they can work together and how things were improved. So things can improve. Better relations can be accepted.
Dr. Shafiq, thank you for making time for the program, and this must be the first of many conversations on what the commission is doing because we've scratched the surface only. Dr. Mohammed Shafiq as a co-chair, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
Bill Johnson, we're going to have to talk about when we're coming back to talk more about this because we've got so much more to get to, and I hope we can do it soon.
We will, Evan.
Bill Johnson is a co-chair. Thank you, Bill. Co-chair of the Rays Commission, former mayor of Rochester. The final report is out. And we will post it for you on our various platforms. You ought to read it. More connections coming up in a moment.